we've decided to incorporate both Rana and Michael Fix into the panel. This way we can have a substantive conversation. So to give you an idea of how we're going to do that, we're going to ask Ellie to make some remarks, some of the points that have been important from the conversation for her, and some additional points that you may want to put on the table. But then Michael Fix is going to talk about some extremely interesting and important research that the Migration Policy Institute is doing about these issues in the United States, which is a cautionary tale about the things that we'll be discussing. But then Rana will make a set of observations from his perspective and where he comes from, and I'm sure a lot of analytical insight will be there. And then I will try to sort of put some of the things that still puzzle me on the table. Then we're going to try to do this fairly efficiently. I don't know what that means. And then we're going to ask you for any concluding observations, remarks, and insights, some that you think we've missed, et cetera, et cetera. And then we'll ask Michael and Rana to close the proceedings. How's that? All right. So, Ellie, the floor is yours.
Okay. This forum clearly demonstrates the superior results that come from regional synergies, which offer the diversity of insights, expertise, and experience from various key stakeholders. We hope that this will add momentum to our objectives and strengthen our collaboration. As we bring the Bali Forum to a close, let me offer my observations on what have emerged from the presentations and discussions. First, I would like to congratulate all those involved in the setting up of the MRAs and the qualifications assurances in their respective countries and professions, and the ASEAN-wide MRAs and ASEAN qualification reference and framework. In spite of the complexities of the processes, the tedious work involved, the obstacles and challenges you have faced along the way, all of you have achieved this seemingly impossible task. Second, I'm happy to note that the process included reaching out to as many stakeholders as possible, some of them non-state actors or usually not involved in seemingly governmental matters. These stakeholders are the professional associations, the universities, the private sector, special employers, and even recruitment agencies, and the students themselves. Third, because of this, it took on a bottom-up approach, which translated into these stakeholders getting invested in the process, owning it as their own, and hopefully that will serve as an impetus to greater dissemination of the information and the opportunity for professional mobility within the ASEAN region. Fourth, both Rana and Guntur pointed to us the significant side benefits of the process. Rana mentioned how the individual countries and governments discovered that regardless of the results of the establishment of ASEAN MRAs and qualification assurances, these are standards that are good by themselves and should become the benchmarks for improving the respective professions, educational systems, skills training, recruitment criteria, monitoring and evaluation procedure, and even their sectoral policies. It was quite exhilarating to note that most of the resource person dwelled on matters beyond MRA and quality assurance. This ranged from policy reform, especially in ASEAN labor mobility, and the maximization of the potential of the human capital in the region. Two, the need for our higher educational systems to prepare for the future and the fast-moving developments, especially in technology. From changing mindsets in relation to an evolving multicultural society and family, to the paramount importance of human capital in global competitiveness and inclusive growth, both in the national and regional levels. From giving equal attention to skills and quality education, to raising awareness towards soft skills, from the out-of-the-box thinking and action by the private sector, to the very innovative ways of raising funds for the ASEAN Secretariat, and this morning, the much bigger picture of the international migration development nexus and the role of the diaspora, both in the host and home countries. The subtext to all this discussion is the reality of the predominance and continuation of low-skill mobility in the region, with its significant percentage of migrants in irregular and undocumented situations. I've called the attention of the participants to the human rights of migrant workers, regardless of migratory status, as articulated in the Cebu Declaration. Finally, any forum related to ASEAN is not worth its salt unless it tackles the realities of the ASEAN itself, its strengths, its weaknesses, and its limitations in relations to other regions in the world, especially the economic powerhouses and socio-political giants of the United States, China, Japan, and even India. In relation to the specific topics of this forum, the metric gave us a reality check with regards to ASEAN. Our technical people in the professional associations, our technocrats and bureaucrats in governments, especially in the regulatory agencies, will do all the nitty-gritty work required by the qualification recognition process. They will cross all the T's and dot all the I's and try to overcome all the obstacles at their level. But eventually, there will be some Gordian knots that only the heads of states could cut. And that's the talk about political will, the final decision makers and power holders of the ASEAN. The question is, will they wield their power in terms of the region's mobility of people, especially considering that it's the key area of AEC 2015, which has lagged far behind to the movement of goods and capital in ASEAN. In closing, let me note the business sector in the person of Dr. Muni Majid, the chair of the ASEAN Business Advisory Council, who is ready to put their money where their mouth is in strengthening and enhancing the role of the business sector in the decision-making processes of the ASEAN. We look forward to this. I thank all the participants of this forum and your respective organizations and constituencies. I leave this forum more hopeful than before, that together we will achieve more than the establishment of MRAs and qualifications framework in our member countries and ASEAN-wide. I leave this forum aware that all of us here were exposed to the long-term objectives of maximizing the human capital potential of our people and the region for a more equitable and inclusive prosperity, development, and growth. I am praying that this exposure will translate to a reality that we all welcome, will nurture, and bring to fruition. To MPI and ADB, you started a very good thing here, but I would like to think the best is yet to be. So thank you to all of you.
So practically speaking, you could stop right here. She did such a great job. So now you get your
the second time I've had to follow Mally in this conference with bad luck, you know? Well, you know, we've been doing this work. Basically, as you think about it, and as everybody in this room knows, there's three ways to expand the mobility and the number of high-skilled migrants in a country. One is to attract them from abroad. A second way is to grow them through education and training. And a third way is to keep them. And one way to keep them is to tap their talents. This is something the United States is not doing a very good job at, and I want my comments that are a little bit off the rails for the conference as a whole. But I think as the region thinks in time, this is an issue it will confront, which is the post-arrival integration of high-skilled immigrants within your societies. We've been doing this work. We've been doing it with Jana Batalova, and I have been doing it. And what we have focused on is high-skilled immigrants with at least a college degree. And what we find, a summary finding, is that over half of high-skilled immigrants in the United States with a four-year degree or more are either unemployed, are working in low-skill jobs, or out of the labor market. The numbers here, if you look at absolute numbers, are really very big. There are over 2 million who are either unemployed or working in low-skill work. And as we think about it, in some ways, if you think through this, this is the worst of all policy worlds. This could be both viewed as brain drain in the sending country and as brain waste in the receiving country. So our research has really tried to get at what accounts, first the total number to quantify this, and then to look at what accounts for this kind of underemployment. And a lot of our findings will be intuitive to you. First, and very importantly, is place of education. Foreign educated immigrants are much more likely to be underemployed. But here, what's interesting in the United States is that nativity doesn't make much of a difference. That is, place of birth doesn't make much difference. Because US educated immigrants in the United States do as well as US natives. This is a testament to integration in the United States. Second, region of origin seems to be quite powerful. Immigrants from Mexico, immigrants from Central America, from Africa. Interestingly, immigrants from the Philippines and from countries in Asia other than India and China experience quite high levels of underemployment within the society. We've been talking a lot about English, and of course it's not surprising that English language skills are critical. There's a huge correlation between employment and wages and English language fluency, regardless of education level. It's not also that surprising that field of study makes a substantial difference. Immigrants who have degrees in engineering or STEM-related degrees are highly rewarded. Those of you with business degrees, the bad news is that business degrees are generally not. Level of education makes a very big difference. The foreign educated with masters and with PhDs and with professional degrees are much less likely to be underemployed compared to their native counterparts than are immigrants with BAs. One surprising finding that we had, surprising to me going into it, that I think may hold implications for confederations like the ASEAN, is in the United States, and we didn't expect this, state of residence makes a big difference in the likelihood of underemployment. So we see that highly educated immigrants in states like Florida are much more likely to be underemployed than immigrants in New York or even our high industrial states of Michigan and Ohio. Irregular status, or legal status, that is to say being unauthorized, makes a big difference. But it doesn't make as big a difference as I think we thought it would find. What we find is that 60% of college-educated immigrants who were undocumented were working in middle and high-skill jobs. This will be a bombshell when we announce it with the report when we come out with it. And then I should note that along with this work on quantifying the numbers and the sources and the rationale and the understanding of what accounts for underemployment among high skills, we're also conducting, if you will, a thought experiment. And the thought experiment is intended to provoke exactly the kind of informed discourse that this group is involved in the ASEAN region. And what we're trying to do is to not just count the number of people who are underemployed, but to estimate what their foregone earnings would have been if they were employed at the same rate and had the same job experience as their native counterparts. This follows on work that's been done by a guy named Jeffrey Wright at the University of Toronto. And then this is to get the attention of stakeholders, but to really get the attention of governments, we're going to go forward and think about what the implications of those foregone earnings would be for increased state, local, and federal taxes that would have been paid by those immigrants. So in short, what we're trying to do, the way we're trying to provoke action, if in fact we find the numbers that we think we are going to find, is to put a price tag on inaction. So I'll stop here, and if you have any hard questions, I'm so grateful that John is here. And I just want to conclude by saying one thing, that is that when Dimitri and I get back, one of the first things, if we ever get back, one of the things we're going to be doing is we're going to be starting in the United States an independent task force on qualifications and credential recognitions among new Americans in the United States. And what we'll be doing is, if you think this is taking the bidirectionality of everything that we have learned from this forum and from these processes and how effective they've been, and trying to bring them back to the United States. So we very much thank you for all your help over the course of these 2 days. Thank you.
Finally, we may have found the perfect way to waste what we say is the ultimate resource. Okay? Human capital. Now, there are peculiarities why this has happened. There is not a clear parallel to what we're discussing here. These are people who have come through family immigration channels. We don't have that problem through the major programs through which employers in the United States bring in workers and employ them, initially temporarily and then permanently. So there are all sorts of things that, you know, are very unique to this study. But the findings are probably even worse in countries that are using point systems for selection. Part of the reason that Australia and Leslie Young has been instrumental, both in the change of Australia, in a sense, away from point systems toward much more hybrid systems that reward prior experience in Australia and employment contracts, et cetera, and in Canada, to the point where we now have no longer any pure point systems. You know what point systems are? They're sort of like a set of attributes that a country wishes to see in its would-be immigrants. And then there are points that are attached to each attribute. And the government plays with what they consider the most important attribute, both in terms of contributing to the economy of the country, presumably the commercial firms, as well as to the success of the immigrants, the integration of the immigrants in that society. So what I'd like to do at this time is turn to Ryan and see what wisdom he has to offer us, and then I'll take my turn and we'll open it to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Dimitri. I will not take too long. I'd just like to stress a couple of points. The first being the one that Simon Long brought up yesterday morning. And his was, he started with a note of skepticism, if you will. And I think for this project, we have to take that skepticism seriously and confront it head on. And in particular, the skepticism was as follows. We have been thinking about this project in terms of the importance of skills mobility to meet the AEC aspirations and for the region's growth and competitiveness. And he questioned, first of all, how much skills mobility mattered. It would be nice to be able to demonstrate that. And perhaps more importantly, does the lack of MRAs really represent a constraint? Now, on that first part, I think the fact that we have multinational firms and large domestic conglomerates who are actively moving people around the region and beyond the region and from outside the region to the region, the fact that they are engaged in these intercorporate transfers suggests clearly that there is an economic gain to be had. These are extremely profit-seeking companies. I think I don't know how much ethics plays or prevents them, but they're clearly profit-driven, and so we can be sure that this kind of skills mobility has an economic benefit. I think what we don't know is whether the approaches that these companies use, whatever they are good enough. Number one. So what would the MRAs do? The second thing where I think there is scope for really digging deeper is fine. The big guys know how to play this game. what about the small and medium firms? Now, in that last discussion, there was a nice exchange about the role of SMEs. I think Dr. Munir brought up this point very nicely, that there are tons and tons of SMEs and lots of different types of policies. But we also know from the international literature, and I think there is some evidence from Asia, it's a bit limited because the data is difficult to get hold of. Basically, you have, you can categorize SMEs into, or rather firms as mice, gazelles, elephants. Elephants are firms which are large and they stay large. It's the gazelles and mice which are the interesting categories, because these are, so the mice are small firms, they remain small. And I don't think we're going to get much bang out of them in terms of developing good jobs or economic growth. The key is the gazelles. Companies that start out small and grow rapidly. And all over the world, these are the big movers and shakers. Now, there are lots of policies the region has to help these SMEs, to help the gazelles, or to call up the gazelles, if you will. And I think, clustering. Clustering was an approach that was talked about by Kato-san, and also this issue of trying to link up SMEs to GVCs. We know that these are two strategies that the region is using, and both are strategies actually where skilled labor can play a very important role. So in some senses, I don't think it's that difficult actually to identify the set of SMEs you want to be working with and really talk to them about how skilled workers, how much of a constraint are the availability or the lack of availability of skilled workers, and then what does it take to be able for them to draw upon skilled workers from outside. So I would suggest that for this project, this is definitely something to focus on. The other parts of this project, I as an outsider, I see that the case is very strong about the MRAs, using the MRAs as a way to really build quality assurance. I think that part is going strong. We're on very good footing. I'm just a little concerned about the other part that Simon Long raised and has come up. So I'm just going to end with that, just to urge the team to think about the firm level stuff. Let's get the data on the big firms, but then let's start going to the small and medium enterprise guys, especially in clusters and those places where they're trying to link GVCs, because that's where I think the action is going to be. Thank you.
So, if we had one more speaker, then I wouldn't have to say a word, because all of the important points have been raised. So I'm trying to see whether I can go around some of the comments that have been made and find and plug some additional holes. I also was going to, and I will go back to what we heard and what the six hard questions for those of you who were here in the very beginning of this event yesterday morning, that our economist friend raised. And I want to focus on two of those six questions, which I think we didn't really answer adequately. There wasn't time, I suspect. And I think Melly also indirectly, she didn't ask it as a question, but when she was talking about equitable and inclusive policies, she was probably suggesting that it may not be enough to have skilled mobility, that there are other things that are more important than that, although skills and the ability of people with skills to move, when they have an opportunity to move and breaking down the barriers, the obstacles to movement, and making certain, as we've heard from Michael, that migration does not become the perfect machine or mobility, the perfect machine to exploit people, to do inequitable things, to be exclusive rather than inclusive, is a critical part of these particular set of circumstances. The other thing that that we heard was, and this is an issue that has been raised indirectly 3 or 4 times in the last 2 days. Is there enough political will to move forward? I know we had a conversation yesterday about the ASEAN Secretariat. In the United States, we have an expression that says, don't complain about the people who are in Congress representing you or in the White House representing you, because essentially you get the politicians that you deserve. In other words, you vote for them. That's why they're there. And from my experience, from all of these other blocs, groupings of states that are trying to organize themselves in ways similar, not identical, to what the ASEAN is doing, one has to wonder about 2 or 3 things. After all these decades, since the beginning, 75, whenever it was, and all of the new emphasis on the goals for 2015 and the ASEAN Economic Community, why aren't we expanding, or how much effort is going into expanding the mandate of the Secretariat? The resources that goes to the Secretariat, the power of the Secretary General. Ong had a wonderful phrase yesterday that the head of the Secretariat is more the secretary rather than a general. Is it because that is what the heads of states want? Some a secretary that will not be all powerful, that will not have a mandate to do things. We spent a lot of time yesterday talking about sanctions. My word, it was punishment or whatever the word that was used, for member states that do not follow the rules. Well, you know, do you want to give the power to the secretariat to sanction member states that do not follow or that violate their commitments? You know, this is not, you know, nuclear science. If there is no power to do that, it means that you don't want to empower the secretariat to actually be able to move the member states forward. In the European Union, I know, believe me, I didn't give a lecture as to how the ASEAN Secretariat is not the Commission, and I can give you a second lecture as to why it should not be like the Commission. But the fact remains, you have to ask the question, how come the head of the Commission is always a rather undistinguished leader from a minor country among the European nations? Clearly, because they do not want the Commission president to become an alternative, and at some point more important than the heads of state. So there are some issues there, it seems to me, that need to be addressed, that in order for the ASEAN group of states to be able to really make progress palpable, measurable, to have goals, for the member states to expect the secretariat to meet these goals, for a system whereby there is, that you know, there are all sorts of measures as to whether each member state is following the things, implementing the things to which they agree, etc., etc. All of those things give you a sense of what member states want and what they do not want. And every time that you're ambivalent about these issues, the proof is the kinds of things that we have been discussing here. Let me also say something about MRAs. We've discussed MRAs to death. We've learned more and shared more information about MRAs than, you know, any of us possibly could want. You know, I had dreams about MRAs yesterday, last night. Not a helpful way to try to sleep. But what is it that is so important about MRAs? We know what is so important. It is something, it's a technical conversation that is supposed to lead to something that's important, which is create a framework that eventually allows the maximum number of people who may wish to move, after they move, to be able to practice their occupation on an equal footing
with the natives. That's all there is. But if they can't move, or they won't move, then the MRA conversation is simply sort of preparing the soil and expecting something else to happen for movement to actually take place. And what that means is that the real conversation, and my colleagues have already put this on the table, and so have many of you around this table, the real conversation is about building the skills and education of your own workforces. The more educated and skilled workers that you have, the more some of them will be willing to move. I love the example about the universities. And, you know, I'm not quite sure how I feel about Erasmus in terms of Erasmus as an education instrument, but Erasmus as a political education system is one of the best inventions of the European Union because it creates Europeans. So that's how you have to think about a lot of these things. It creates ASEAN, not nationals, people who actually are, you know, become comfortable operating in the multinational environment, understanding that they come from a special place, you know, in the world, building connections, creating careers regardless of where they came from, breaking down all the obstacles to mobility, or for that matter, the recognition of diplomas and qualifications. It costs money, we all know that, but as an effort that would actually lead to a different future for the ASEAN nations, it's a perfect way to invest real money. Okay, I have no idea how much university education costs in the region. I'm sure it costs different amounts of money in Indonesia versus Laos versus whatever, a third country. And I imagine it's probably expensive, but coming from the United States, I haven't had to put two kids through college. And now people who are putting kids through college now and looking at $70,000 a year to educate a child, I'm sure it's not that expensive, is it? Thank you. I would have had to kill myself. So these are the kinds of conversations that we ought to be having, together with completing the conversations about MRAs, and then expanding the number of professions, and getting to a point, 3, 5, 10 years from now, where you have enough people who are educated, who are professionals, who want to move, because they've learned how to move, because they got educated across the region, because we have created a new sort of person. And those are the kinds of things that will make a difference at the end of the day in terms of the area, the region, moving forward. And we've had conversations, thankfully. Munir came last night, and he has forced that conversation upon all of us. The business sector, private sector, call it whatever it is. You know, we make so many assumptions when we talk. We're careless, all of us. You know, we think that competitiveness is somehow something that countries do, that governments do. Competitiveness starts with competitive firms. Competitive firms become competitive because they do what Michael said. They know how to grow talent. They know how to create conditions for talent. Keeping talent doesn't mean you force it to stay. It means you create conditions for the talent to actually want to stay, because it creates opportunities for advancement for their family, etc., etc., etc. Some of them will move, inevitably. Some of them will move out of the region, inevitably. There is a pecking order. Every time I say that, people get upset. You know, there is, you know, a pecking order as to where people want to go. The best people will go to the place where they can get the best returns on their own investments in their own education and training. The fastest returns. It's never the EU. That's why the EU has all of these systems to try to
you know, attract people from the outside. They have something they call a blue card with no limits. After 7 years of a blue card, there have only been 22,000 people who have moved to the EU. Why? It's not because the EU is not a place where you can have a stable employment, you can be rewarded properly, it has a good support system, social supports, etc., etc. And it's because the best people want to go to places where they can make money. And the fastest way to make money if you're on top of your game happens to be essentially one place, or one place with two other places, falling behind. The United States with Canada and Australia, you know, behind that. So, in order for us to be able to make the kind of growth that we want, we have to also realize some of the very best people are going to move. These are the people whom you might as well think of as global citizens. They're the true cosmopolitans. The people who will go because they have offers all the time. Interestingly enough, if the test of someone being a superstar is how much they can get paid and how many offers they have, in today's world, there are very few superstars. All of the other skilled labor is essentially that. And you don't see the price of skilled labor going up in a measurable way, in a significant way, in the rest of the world. Maybe competition will lead to the evidence that we all need to say, yes, there's competition for something, which is the marketplace, takes over and says, you know, because there is a global shortage, I don't know, of pharmacists, we're going to bid up the price for pharmacists. And you'll see pharmacists beginning to get, you know, 20% more than the previous cohort of pharmacists. We have no evidence that this is happening anywhere. But we do know that people choose to go where they think they can actually be more successful. It is the responsibility of the ASEAN nations to try to get as many of those people to stay here, and people who have the point of non-made diasporas, people who have left, to attract them back. So that's the essence of competition. That's when firms can grow. That's when things can happen. Whether it starts, as it often does with SMEs, with people who really have innovation in their DNA, it's woven into them, people who are risk takers, people who have great education, people who are the thinkers. That's why the emphasis of so many of the countries that try to attract masses of well-educated and well-prepared people is on mathematics. It is on engineering. Hard sciences. It is on technology, information, informatics. Because these kind of people can make the biggest difference in the taking off of a particular firm. And multinationals that learn the lesson that when you put together in a research laboratory people from all sorts of different countries that have different experiences, that have complementary skills. Many of the best companies now, in addition to having engineers, et cetera, they also have anthropologists on their research teams. Think about it. And sociologists. The people who are asking me, why are we doing this? What's the value that comes out of this? So, yes, it is critical that we finish our job with the MRAs, that we expand the number of occupations, that we get into a habit of cooperating by understanding that cooperation is the very essence of how you get ahead. Competition is natural. It will happen. You don't have to work hard at introducing competition. You have to work extremely hard at introducing cooperation. And this is also an essential, in a sense, element of this conversation. And I will finish by as we were having our lunch panel, I made a list. It's probably not well thought through, but nonetheless, I'll tell you what the list was. What are the positive things? Why do we need to have MRAs? What are the advantages of MRAs? They introduce an order and a certainty when it comes to outcomes. But if you're an engineer, a civil engineer from country X, okay, you have the qualifications, which means you can do all the things that the civil engineer needs to do, regardless of whether you came from country X or country Y. It is a process of also understanding how to work together in order to agree on important things. It's an incremental process, a process of learning by doing. It's essential if you want to begin to act as a region. Not every region can do that well, but maybe you have an opportunity to do that. It is a systematic way of measuring what is needed and on testing against those measures whether an individual or an individual who has a degree from any particular university actually can meet those criteria. It is a set of rules that creates a level playing field. This way we don't exploit people. Again, if the objective of all this motion, movement, mobility is to exploit people, there are easier ways to do that. Illegal immigration is the easier way of doing that. Just in case I don't want to be obtuse about that. It is something that introduces fairness into the system. It allows or it creates opportunities for much less gaming of the system where people can fake things. And at the end, most importantly, it reduces the potential for exploitation. And all the negatives, the opposites of what I said, is when you do not have an organized system of acknowledging and evaluating whatever people bring with them. So, I think the agenda that if I were, made the general secretary of the secretariat or a czar for 1 minute of, the 10 member states, what I would focus on is continue with the process of the MRAs. Educate, train, bring the business sector. They know where the jobs are. They know what are the likely jobs, not 10 years from now, nobody knows that nowadays, but they certainly know what is the likelihood that they will need the skill set that they will need 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. You can't rely on blind measures like unemployment. You have to look forward. You look at the job growth in an occupation. It is the best measure that you can use in order to figure out what kinds of skills you may be able, you're likely to need 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. Look at employment growth rather than employment rates or unemployment. And educate. And by that I mean start with eliminating literacy. Everybody getting a primary education. Pretty much everybody finishing high schools, secondary education. Let's make sure that people understand when they go to university what their options are in terms of post-graduation employment. Let curriculum also be shaped, not determined, shaped by the business sector. Put businessmen in the leadership, if there are advisory bodies in universities, make sure they have 3 or 4 businessmen. We put businessmen on these advisory bodies or boards because we want their money. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about business people who will actually help shape how education is done. Not determinant, but introduce some reality into the whole game. And once again, I may have said that in the last 2 days, if people want to go and study poetry, more power to them. If they are unemployed and have to drive taxes, that's also a decision that they have to make. If poetry teaches a discipline, however, of how to think and how to say things in a very efficient way, that is all about how you basically create a mind, shape a mind that can solve problems, then poetry can be very helpful. And this is, I think, the agenda for all of us. Incidentally, this isn't just an agenda for the ASEAN. You know, if you look at my country, the United States, I could be saying the same thing, you know, in a room full of Americans. Because no country has even begun to solve the kinds of issues that we're talking about here. All of us need to do a much better job. So, I'm sorry I've talked too much. I apologize to my colleagues, I apologize to you. It's your turn now to make any comments you wish to make, and then we're going to allow our bosses here to close this event. Wow. You see, we started with you, okay? We basically said all there is to say. All right, Michael and Rana, you have a job to do now. You can just, okay. All right. You need to do this.
Well, just another half hour to go. Just a joke there. I'll just say, I don't know whether you're going to welcome it, but I just wanted to tell you about the products that you can expect from this project over the next several months. And first, there will be a report on the mobility trends of the high field and the IVM that we have. All these are products that we have discussed in one way or another over the course of the meeting. We'll have a report from the ADB on the projections of future supply and demand for high skill in the region. We'll have a report written by Maria Vincenza on the progress and barriers to implementation of MRAs within the ASEAN. We're also going to have a report on the differing sectors implementation of MRAs. And then we'll have a report that compares MRAs in the region to comparable arrangements in the EU, in North America, and in other places, and their adoption in the ASEAN. Finally, you should know that ADB, MPI, and our partners from JICA will convene a regional roundtable early next year. And then I would just want to say to thank you all for a remarkable, from my perspective, for a remarkable 2 days, and to thank ADB and JICA, and I really want to, as they say, give a shout out to our own Brian Salant, who asked such an intelligent question at lunch. And of course to Dublin, but in terms of Brian, you have to understand that he's newly married, and he essentially hasn't been home in the last 2 weeks, and I think part of the reason he's getting away with it is that his wife is a Filipino. So once again, thank you, and I'll now pass the baton for the last time to Rana.
Thank you, Michael, and friends and colleagues, thank you very much. It's been an excellent 2 days. I know that for a number of you, it doesn't end here, and in fact, tomorrow, there's a development of the country action plans, so which Kudru was talking about. So for those of you who are staying on, I wish you a very productive session. And I think going forward, You know, Michael has talked about some of the milestones that we hope to achieve by next year. It's certainly a very important project for us at ADB in the research department. Usually we do research that's sort of ivory tower in the sense that we go ahead, we analyze an issue, and then we publish it, and that's it, we move on. But this is a project which really, it's not like that. There is the analysis component, but it's so much geared towards something very real. It's bringing together a number of different players and just working continuously with them. This process started out several months ago. I had the opportunity to see it in action in terms of the focus group discussions that were held a few weeks back, and then in Manila, and now just a few days ago here in Bali. So it's really quite an incredible process, seeing so many different stakeholders from different ministries, different agencies, just working at what is clearly a very long-term agenda. But I think, you know, it's been said very nicely that a lot of growth, economic development is about people and people moving. And so we are really privileged to be part of this project, and thank you all so much for this very active participation, and thank you also to the strong support from the Japan Fund and from JICA. Thank you very much, and thank you all, and hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.
And I just want to have a special attention to Gunther and to Dublin, and to really thank you from MPI's perspective for your leadership over this project. So.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.